Welcome to the Biology of Trauma podcast, the show that provides professionals with the knowledge and tools for effective, science-based solutions for the trauma healing journey. I am your host, Dr. Amy, and I've done the hard work so you can stop your endless searching, have a roadmap for your own work, and be able to help others more powerfully. Welcome to this episode of the Biology of Trauma podcast. I am your host, Dr. Amy. In this episode, I am teaching how an early life experience of a heart shock shapes our biology and psychology. If our early life experiences involved a heart shock, our biology can be programmed for danger through something called neuroception. Most times, we haven't even recognized that we experienced a heart shock, but that doesn't mean it didn't leave its mark. It happened so early that the effects have always been with us. We don't know anything different. In this episode, we are answering the one question: what is the impact of an early life heart shock on our mind and body? Here's what all we will cover in this episode: understanding what a heart shock is, how early life heart shocks affect attachment and survival, examples of early life heart shocks and their impact, the cellular, tissue, and system level effects of heart shocks, how heart shocks change our nervous system and neuroception, the connection between early life heart shocks and adult diseases, recognizing the part of us affected by early life shocks, the importance of being a hero for that part of us. I can't wait to share this information with you. It will open your eyes to our incredible resilience and fragility. Here's how this teaching landed for Susan, one of my advanced professionals in training.
I'm thinking often if there has been some birth trauma, and so that even like the neck may have been wrenched some or whatever, if that's not caught right away and you've gone through, so you never get that body memory, you know, the muscle memory on how to do these things, even if you go back and then try to do that adjustment, I would think there's probably a good chance it won't hold until you really work with the whole system and work it. And I would just think how common this must be too, where a cord gets compressed, if not completely wrapped around the neck, but compressed coming down, or there's a vacuum extraction, you know, or forceps or whatever. And then the mom has been like drugged out because so she's not available and possibly goes into postpartum depression. I would imagine a pretty common pattern. This is very powerful. Thank you so much, Dr. Amy. This is putting a lot of pieces together.
As we come to the topic of heart shocks, specifically what we want to look at is the effect on the mind and the body with heart shocks in early life. To understand that, we really are still looking at attachment, because heart shocks are going to involve the attachment process, affect the attachment and bonding, and then be creating so many of the same chronic diseases. There are a few that are highlighted in their relationship with early heart shocks because of what it does to the mind and body. And of course, as I always talk about heart shocks, I always think of Miguel, and this is how I got even started with anything related to trauma, was really working with him and the heart shocks that he would have endured as a young baby. So what is a heart shock? Let's start there as a review and bring in the attachment piece. So the elements of a heart shock. The first one is that it's unexpected. That's why it is a shock. It's unexpected. In the case of an infant, we do come into this world with an assumption that we are going to be taken care of and protected. That's wired into our being, as attachment is wired into our being. When something happens that is so contrary to what we expected to have happen, then that can bring in the element of a shock. It is so unexpected. Did not see it coming. Because of that element of a shock then, and it being so unexpected, it causes an immediate overwhelm. There isn't the usual stress response first, and we're going to intend to take action. We may be able to take action. Then there's this thwarted movement. All of that happens in a single instant in time. It's so compressed that, yes, our system still experiences that uprise into sympathetic, this thwarted movement, panic, freeze, and then shut down. But it is so compressed because it all happens together. What causes this immediate response of overwhelm? We call that the trauma response in the body because of what is happening on the cellular level. That's the body's going into a trauma response. Because of this element that it is immediate and it causes such rapid shifting of our states, then the impact can be hard to complete the response. We know that in order for a trauma to not become stored in our body, we need to complete the trauma response when it happens. When we complete responses, they don't become stored in our body. But the impact of a shock makes it very hard to complete the response at that time. And that is why it becomes stored trauma in the body, because we're not able to complete it. Because it becomes stored in our body, in the nervous system specifically, it can severely disrupt a child's ability to trust and to feel safe. So these elements of a heart shock are what make it hard for a child to then still be able to trust and to feel safe. It wasn't a slow process that they even had time to understand that a change was happening and let me have time and space to adapt to this change and think what I might want to do. It was so sudden. It was so unexpected. It compressed the whole, all of those steps of the trauma response into one single moment in time that it so disrupts the ability to process that it becomes stored and disrupts their ability to feel safe and to trust. As I think of this, I'm reminded of this family that I worked with. She was a foster mom. She came into the family challenge camps that I was running at that time. I was teaching what I had learned about parenting Miguel. She was working with a sibling set that she was foster parenting. This was the oldest son of that sibling set. His hand behind her back is not touching her, is not holding her. Even though his heart shock happened years ago and he's been safe, that's not what his body perceives. He still cannot trust. He still cannot feel safe. And he's definitely not in danger right now in this present moment, but yet it has so disrupted his ability to trust that she will even hold his body up and he can let go of the chair and not have to hold himself up. That's how much it has disrupted his ability to trust someone else. I have to hold myself up in this chair because if I let go and hold on to her, ooh, I can't trust that she will hold me up. Even though logically his brain will be able to decipher that, that's not what his body and neuroception are informing him.
The boy leaning on the couch, being held. And it made me think of my own experience. And last week I did some work, neuroaffective touch, and the muscles in the back and this vigilance and this like literal inability to like receive the touch. And it just made me think of that. And so this chronic pattern of vigilance, but then like not even knowing what it feels like to relax that. So not having that body knowledge, like that this can relax and not be held in such a vigilant way, going right back to like how much of that there is in the bracing where there is no knowledge in the body of how to feel different.
And so the elements of a heart shock is a form of attachment trauma. Shock in early life is a form of attachment trauma, because it's causing a trauma response. So as we go back to the definition of trauma, it's going to be the same definition as an attachment trauma. Anything that for any reason at that time in our life caused an experience of overwhelm of the body. A heart shock in early life is a form of attachment trauma. It caused a trauma response in the body. And so attachment, why would this be brought into the equation, and what are the consequences? What's the impact? When we understand that attachment is not just our emotions and it's not just our relationships, attachment is a baby's survival. Any baby cannot survive without someone else to help care for it. It can't get its own food. It can't regulate itself. So attachment is one's survival. The attachment was the degree of internal regulation of the nervous system. And when we look at the effect of a heart shock, by the reason that it creates a trauma response and becomes stored, that becomes dysregulation. And so the heart shock is going to impact the degree of internal regulation that a baby, that an infant, that a child will then develop coming out of their childhood. And this attachment becomes our basis for neuroception. It's a concept we're going to go further into detail in this talk. And it really is one of the key and core principles of polyvagal theory, this idea of neuroception, meaning that my nervous system is wired for perceiving things, not for truly assessing reality. Neuroception forms our intuition, and our intuition is not based on reality. It is based on our neuroception, which is the perception of our nervous system. And our attachment is what becomes the basis for our neuroception or our perception of safety or danger. Attachment sets the whole tone for our nervous system because it's happening during neurodevelopment. It is literally shaping our nervous system. That's why it has significant implications for the rest of our life in every area of our life, because it is what is setting the whole tone. It is shaping our neurodevelopment. Attachment shapes our neurodevelopment just as much as neurodevelopment will affect our attachment. But we're really looking at the degree of regulation or dysregulation. Some examples of what would be an early life heart shock. We can have a heart shock in utero. We can be exposed to things that are such a shock to our system that we experience that moment of shock, panic, and shutdown. This will also happen if there's any, I want to say, complications in utero, where the life of the baby is at risk. That can be experienced as a shock to the growing fetus. A birth trauma, a cord wrapped around the neck. That can be a shock because it's unexpected. And all of a sudden, I don't have what I need to stay alive. This is not what I expected. This is not supposed to happen. So anything around birth trauma may be experienced as an early life heart shock. What will definitely be experienced as heart shocks is any separation from mom after birth, and whether that is to the NICU because there's complications, whether that's because we've decided to adopt this baby out. Separation is a heart shock to a newborn. It is not what is supposed to happen. And it creates such a survival crisis for the baby, because it does not think it can survive being separated from birth mom. For such a long time, there's been this philosophy that if you adopt a baby at birth, they'll be fine. They won't have experienced trauma and they won't remember. And so you won't have as many challenges as adopting once they're older. And by older, several months, years. My father was adopted at birth. Once he was born, he was never placed with his birth mom. There was instant separation. And I will definitely tell you that he has still struggled with all of the attachment pains that come from early life separation and that degree of heart shock. Understanding the nervous system, understanding what the experience would be for a baby is very different than what we as adults can think through and create what we would think would be our experience. But that's not what happens. The trauma and the shock is what we experience at that time in our life with the knowledge that we had at that time, with the maturity that we had at that time. That's where a lot of the, I want to say, just like the professionals still need to move towards that understanding, because so much of it is still based on, well, they shouldn't experience it as a trauma. This shouldn't be hard for them. Even babies in the NICU and all of these bright lights and fluorescent lights shining on them constantly. What's the experience for the baby? Like that could be experienced as a shock to their system where this is not how it's supposed to go. I'm supposed to be held. I'm supposed to be protected. I'm supposed to be with my mom. And I'm on this hard thing and there's all these lights and there's these IV lines in my body and people come and they poke me and they cause me pain. That's all that they know. And so being able to put ourselves in that situation, at that place with that understanding and resources and nervous system development gives us a much more accurate view of what could be experienced as a shock to an infant. So along those lines, everything, even to medical procedures, could be experienced as a heart shock to a baby. And this can be even out to 3 years of age. After that, they seem to be able to have some logic and rationale that they can understand why they're having a procedure and they can work more through that. But anything younger than that, they just don't have the brain developed enough to understand that you're going to be okay. This is good for you. This is going to help you feel better. They experience it as a separation and they experience it as a, I think I'm going to die. And that degree of shock and impact is then what creates this response in the body. Maternal depression is one that we need to consider because as an infant is coming out and they're engaging with mom, they need to see her. And by seeing her, I mean, they need to see the life in her. If when they look in her eyes, she's not really there, that is a survival crisis to the baby because they're depending on her and her life within her to sustain their life. And so that type of interaction where mom's not really there, physically she's there, but they're looking into eyes that seem dead, that seem numb, that seem flat, even though she's going through the motions, even though she's feeding the baby, even though the baby is taken care of. That is not what their experience will be internally because of what they need in terms of attunement. They need to feel like they are seen. And if mom does not have the life in her eyes, if she doesn't have the sparkle in her eyes, she's not going to be able to give that experience of reflection and the mirroring that happens for the healthy development of the brain and the nervous system to feel seen, to feel heard, to feel understood, to feel cared for, protected. The baby will not have that experience of those sensations in their body, even though the actions are still being done. So baby cries and mom comes in and picks baby up. But if baby isn't getting the attunement in her eyes and with her body, it will still be experienced as I'm alone. I'm alone. This adult is not really here, creating that survival crisis and can experience a shock with that. And then the last one is physical injury. And so any kind of a physical injury can be a shock to the system. So one of the things that I know about Miguel and his experience was that somewhere around 6 months of age, he broke his clavicle. He broke his collarbone. We have a story that we were told later of how that might have happened, but he was never taken to the hospital. He was never cared for. And so that kind of a physical injury would have been experienced as a shock to a baby that's never broken a bone before, doesn't even know what that means to break a bone, has no idea this degree of pain and all of the experience that comes with that, where I'm a baby, I'm supposed to move, yet when I move, I'm in pain. I'm supposed to breathe, yet when I breathe, it hurts. All of that can be experienced as a shock to a baby that has no concept for understanding what just happened. And so whether that's an injury or whether that's a physical abuse, and having a pain, a physical pain caused by someone who's supposed to protect you. They're supposed to only make me feel cared for. And now I just experienced significant pain from them. That's a shock. That's a shock to the system. That's a shock to our system as an adult. Imagine the shock to a system for a baby who doesn't even have any understanding of what that person might be going through and that this really has nothing to do with them. This has everything to do with a person, but that is not the experience of the baby. So that can be another form of shock. So what's happening then in response to this shock? There's a lot of things that are happening in the body as a result of this kind of shock at the cellular level. So everything inside of the cells are moving to energy conservation. This is going to be a problem because baby is supposed to be growing. Now there's this competition between, all right, we'll send some energy to grow, but we're going to conserve as much energy as we can, as opposed to being able to put it all to growing and thriving and playing and learning and connecting. There's this tension that develops at the cellular level between what do we have to do for growth and survival, and what can I conserve? At the tissue level, we're going to have either increased tension, which we call bracing. These are attachment bracing patterns that are there to guard us from even feeling the ongoing impact and pain from a heart shock. Or other tissues can have a lack of tone. This is part of that energy conservation. Yes, we can have a combination of both, so that some muscle groups are bracing and other muscle groups just go lax. There's just no tone. That is because of the energy conservation and because they've already gone into this place of there's nothing that I can do. There's no point in even trying. So the muscles can lose their lack of tone. On a system level, the digestive system takes a hit because of the changes in the nervous system. The immune dysregulation starts to happen. And on a behavioral and emotional level, we can see both a guarding and an I don't care syndrome. And again, the I don't care syndrome is the equivalent of the lack of tone in the muscles, where the don't care syndrome is just do whatever you want. I'm just surviving my childhood. I'm just biding my time until I can get out of here. I don't care syndrome. So they're not actively fighting. This is a passive way to survive.
Speaks to so much of when I was working with children, one of the hallmarks was they always had low tone. Why do all these kids have low tone? What is this low tone? And there was never an answer for that. That was just a symptom. That was just one of the things that you always looked for. It was so frustrating because I always knew I was missing something. I always knew that there was something that I didn't understand. There was always a system there. It was a family system as well. There was so much going on. And when that child has low tone, they're missing out on so much because there's so much that they can't do, that they can't experience, that their movement is always compromised, which then is a whole domino effect for their whole life. So frustrating trying to get these kids to increase their tone. And you do all the therapy things and you'd put them in the hammocks and you'd put them on the scooter boards and it never felt like enough. What I'm really noticing too is the attachment issue is that parent gets blamed and the parent will take the guilt of that as well. And so therein lies a whole nother dynamic. And something I've heard often in autistic circles as well, that there's a realization that part of an autistic's sort of process is learning to realize that their parent wasn't to blame. That's a big dynamic. That relationship needs to be healed. And that was just really helpful to hear that again from that perspective that the baby can't not blame the parent. Their system can't not blame the parent. That is the dynamic. Heartbreaking. It's a heartbreaking dynamic.
But in the nervous system specifically, there are patterns that start to develop. One of these patterns is just a pattern of reactivity. So yes, in the brain, there's lots of changes. In the autonomic nervous system, there's all of these changes as it's trying to navigate the three states of our autonomic nervous system and already floating between the sympathetic and the overwhelmed most of the time. So the system gets wired in for being more reactive. We see this as the example of the global high intensity activation. That can be a result and part of the effects of an early life heart shock. That we know is just a pattern of intense reactivity. We react in the extremes. And then another adaptation to the nervous system specifically is the neuroception. So our neuroception is the job of our autonomic nervous system to perceive our present sense of danger or safety so that it knows what to do. And by perceiving in every given moment how my environment is changing, then that allows me to know how to adapt in every given moment that is far beyond or beneath my conscious awareness. As we look at neuroception, it is picking up what we call cues, and it's gathering cues from our external environment. It's gathering cues from our relational interactions, and it's gathering cues from our internal environment. All of these come together to form its decision for what is my current degree of danger. If there's no sense of danger, then I can be in safety and I'm going to be in ventral vagal parasympathetic and I'm going to play and I'm going to smile and I'm going to engage. If I have cues of danger, then I'm either in sympathetic, unless the sense of danger is an overwhelming sense of danger, then I'm in that shutdown in the dorsal vagal. Our nervous system is constantly doing this through that ability for neuroception. And the absence of danger does not mean that it is a cue for safety. So it's not just the absence of cues of danger that we need to be providing, but it's actually providing cues of safety. That's then how the autonomic nervous system registers, ooh, got it, I'm safe, and I can go into the parasympathetic state where I will grow and thrive my best. The challenge, of course, comes with the changes that have happened on the cellular level with the changes in the nervous system, the digestive system, the immune system, the nervous system, and it's wired for reactivity. It's wired for stress. It's wired now because of an early life heart shock. It's wired to see danger when there is no danger because it has learned that the unexpected can happen. If the unexpected can happen, well, then even when things are good, oh, it's still not good. I'm still not safe. Because the unexpected could happen. So it literally wires our neuroception for constantly having cues of danger. That's why when we start working with people, we sometimes can't use the word safe. Are you safe? Do you feel safe? Because the answer will always be no. Always be no. So that's why when we start working with them, especially if they've had an early life heart shock, we need to use the word safer. Do you feel safe? Because we're going to have to baby step this. There's no way that they can go from a lifetime of having constantly felt unsafe to, well, yes, I feel completely safe right now. You are a miracle worker. No, their body doesn't feel safe to feel safe. They always feel like they have to be on guard because they're expecting the unexpected. And because of the changes in their biology, they have all of these cues of danger coming from their own biology now. So they have cues of danger coming from their mitochondria. They have cues of danger coming from their immune system and the inflammation. So that even though they're not consciously aware of any danger in their external environment, their internal environment is giving them all kinds of cues of danger. This is what we get stuck in. This is what is a biology of trauma. This is how it plays out with the early life shock, is that neuroception has formed since early life and attachment. It is wired for seeing danger, even when there is no danger. And those changes in the nervous system have created a biology of trauma. That biology of trauma now perpetuates cues of danger. We know that there are significant changes that are happening even as young as 3 years of age that can be measured because of studies that they've done on the brain. They've looked at different effects of neglect on brain imaging. It's hard to measure the changes in a nervous system and how it's communicating things. If we're going to rely on imaging, we have to rely on structural changes, but there are even significant structural changes by 3 years of age. And so if this is the degree of change that we can measure in the brain with extreme neglect, we can imagine the changes that are happening with an early life shock. We're stuck in this loop now where the nervous system is creating more changes in our biology and the biology is perpetuating that dysregulation and the cues of danger to our neuroception. And so the heart shock in early life creates the three most challenging types of grief. all in one. It creates an attachment grief because if I experienced a heart shock, someone didn't do their job to protect me. And so even if it didn't happen with the parent still gets blamed in terms of the baby's nervous system because that is the parent's job in their mind. That is their expectation of how life is supposed to go. So even if the heart shock happened as a result of a medical procedure, for the baby, they're still making the decision unconsciously that their parent cannot be trusted to protect them. And so there's also this degree of absent grief because I didn't get what I needed. I didn't get the protection. I didn't get even the ability to process this. We're going to go into that in a little bit for what do we do now? I didn't have someone who understood what I was going through and who knew what to do. I was all alone. And the heart shock is the other most challenging type of grief. That's because of how compacted it is that our body goes into that trauma response. Everything happens in a moment's time. When heart shocks happen in early life, we are going to see health diseases as adults. Autoimmunity being a big one because it starts that immune dysregulation so early. It also starts to bring in those parts of us that we think we are the problem. That is actually an essential element to developing an autoimmune process, is that along the way, we have come to the conclusion that we are the problem. We are not enough. We were not pretty enough. We were not enough. There's something wrong, inadequate, different about me. I am the problem. So I will attack myself. IBS, really, it's all digestive issues because of how early then that the nervous system is causing dysregulation in the gut and the enteric nervous system. So it's going to affect our gut permeability. Everyone with an early life shock is going to have problems with boundaries. And we'll need to do boundaries work. That's all the way down to the tissue level because their gut has not had and been able to develop a healthy boundary. Chronic fatigue is another one, just because of the degree and how early this sympathetic response started with sending adrenaline into our system and not being able to complete responses. And over lots of time and lots of years, that results in chronic fatigue. So this is why when someone comes in for a biology of trauma health coaching session, we're assessing these kinds of symptoms, diseases, conditions, because this is our way of trying to assess early life dysregulation. And the more problems they have, that is a sign that the earlier or maybe to the more degree of early life dysregulation that they had, that it's compounded over time. So in essence, this is a way to measure the trauma burden of the body. And a heart shock would have started that burden early. But with heart shock, there's this element that we have parts of us, not just the biology. There is a part of us. How that presents oftentimes is that as we're working with a person, we get this sense that, are they self-sabotaging? Do they really want to get better? Because they tell me that they want to get better, but then they do things that block their ability to get better. Oftentimes, this self-sabotage that will come up, and whether that's with a trauma therapy protocol or whether that's a medical protocol, the self-sabotage shows up in all of those areas because there is this part of them that doesn't have the energy and doesn't believe that they can get better. There is that part of them that at that time, it was such a shock that they might die, that perhaps they wanted to die. What they were feeling was so extreme, they didn't want to be there. They didn't want to be feeling that degree of pain and heart shock, especially in early life. Sometimes as we go deeper into the parts work, we can even have this understanding and insight from their parts as we do dialogues and conversations, where we discover that this part actually feels that, I don't know, maybe life is too hard. If this is what life is, I don't know if this is what I wanted. This is not what I expected. Going back to that element of unexpected with the heart shock. These are all insights that we can have. And generally, by themselves, people are going to be so afraid of this part of them that they won't even give it any time, any attention. They will shove it down. They will avoid it. They will sometimes not even be aware that they have this part. So one of the most powerful things that we get to do as practitioners is to be able to show that we don't need to be afraid of this part. Even just that is a powerful shift, that we don't need to be afraid of this part. So many times people will say, but this part is suicidal. I know that that's the language that this part can use sometimes. And to me, that makes perfect sense that they would say those kinds of things and being able to acknowledge that. I mean, it's a scary thing to admit that I've had thoughts that I don't want to be alive because life is too hard. Just normalizing this and putting it as, but this is just a part of you, because you do have another part of you that very much wants to be alive. Isn't that interesting that we can have even this tension inside of us? We can have two parts that feel completely opposite. My guess is that you've never wanted to listen and pay attention to this one part. You've only wanted to give attention to the part of you that wants to be alive. Now we can have some curiosity develop around this part. But until we can show that we're not afraid of this part, it often is so scary for them that they are afraid to even go there or admit that they might have a part of them that doesn't want to get better because it doesn't even want to be alive. That doesn't mean that they're suicidal. That means that they have a part of them that experienced so much pain that it wasn't sure that it wanted to go on. That's it. That's all that means. And so as we look at how this part of them can present, the other aspect that we can often see, and it is often hidden underneath their guarded protection, right? It's not always on the surface. They may try to hide it well with caffeine and other things that even hide that from themselves, but this chronic functional freeze, this part of them is in a chronic functional freeze. And this is why when we start to do some of the somatic work and we start to bring in moments of safety, and we are going to need to microdose safety, that they can not go into parasympathetic and calm aliveness. They can go all the way immediately down into the freeze response, and all they feel is heavy and they just want to go to sleep. And so that's a sign for us of just how much their body is working with this functional freeze and trying to stay above it. To wrap up, what does this part need? This part needs a hero. This part needs a hero, or a shiro, whatever you are. This part needs a hero. This part needs someone to come back and save it. It's like a story of, you know, someone who got left in a burning building and the hero comes back to save them. That's what we need to do. This part needs a hero. They can't do it alone. They can't. They need a hero. So they will stay stuck there as long as they feel alone. So the first thing that we need to do then is to just be there. Need to learn how to just be there. And so many of us, by the time we've reached adulthood, especially if we are practitioners, we are in fix-it mode. No, I need to come save you because I need to fix you. And that's not what this part needs first. It has lost all trust and all sense of safety. It doesn't trust you that you're going to be able to fix it. So it has to trust you first, and then it will follow your guidance. We get to learn how to be the trusted leader guide for our own selves that are still stuck in shock and fear. We have covered a lot in this episode. Thank you for joining me. As always, I will have the links in the show notes for you. If you're looking to learn how to become that trusted leader for yourself, you will want to take your foundational journey. This is a journey I lead that is a journey into your own nervous system. You learn how to create that felt sense of safety in your body, especially after being stuck in danger mode for so long. For those of you who will want to take some of the biology of trauma professional training yourself, the foundational journey is your foundational module. It covers the essential sequence and the essential knowledge for really knowing how to apply the biology of trauma. Speaking of the essential sequence, there is an essential sequence to safely addressing early heart shock or any form of stored trauma in the body. If we don't follow the sequence that honors the biology and science of trauma, we run the risk of re-traumatizing ourselves in the process. So I will include the link for the essential sequence guide where I walk you through those three steps and in the essential sequence for safely addressing stored trauma. Those are the steps that I lead you through in the foundational journey. I will include some links for YouTube videos that are related to this topic. I will also include the links for a few podcast episodes related to this topic. There's one in particular on self-sabotaging parts, early young insecure parts of us that self-sabotage, and another podcast episode on healing our families, a story of adoption. If you are ready to dive into the biology aspect of addressing stored trauma, I will include the links to what I've seen are some important biology pieces to bring in. There are a couple of supplements that come to mind that could support your biology if you are relating to early life stress and heart shocks. Your body has been in chronic stress and trauma mode for a very long time. Cellular energy support is something that you will want to bring in. This will bring energy into your system that has been stuck in trauma because of a lack of energy. It's one of the trauma patterns that develops, a lack of energy. And so cellular energy support is a specific supplement that I use, has ingredients like ashwagandha, rhodiola, holy basil. These help support our energy system so we have the energy to come out of chronic trauma. And then magnesium. Magnesium gets depleted in chronic stress. And when our body has been holding tension patterns for a long time, we are likely deficient in magnesium. It's time to support our body, and it's a great place to start. I take magnesium during the day. I take magnesium at night to help me sleep well. I also take magnesium to help with brain inflammation and brain fog. So I will include the links to the three different kinds of magnesium that I use. I use one for the day, I use one for sleep, and I use one for brain inflammation. They're different forms of magnesium, and so I would want you to be choosing the one that would best serve your life at this point. I'm your host, Dr. Amy, and until next episode, lots of love.
Thank you for joining me today. If you enjoyed today's show, be sure to subscribe. We definitely will learn, laugh, and sometimes cry together on this healing journey, and you won't want to miss an episode. Give my podcast 5 stars, share it with a friend or colleague. If you felt an impact as it truly helps get the word out and breaking the paradigm of how we do trauma work. I look forward to seeing you back here next week. Until then, this is your host, Dr. Amy, sending you lots of love.